Before I turn this over to Brother Ray, I just had a couple announcements to make. First one is for the young people, over to Brother Ray, and he has for us this evening our Vesper, of course, and those who are participating in it are right up here in front, so I know that we're going to enjoy this. Brother Ray.
Dear brethren, it's been a busy day, sweet day. A day of blessing and a day of memories that we will long cherish. And as we have spent the past hours just sitting in the heavenlies, we now turn and recognize day is dying in the west. And as we see the mantle of darkness beginning to cover the earth, we realize too that our day of just chewing the cud, as it were, the afterglow of the previous hours begins to settle down and begins to give us an opportunity for meditating and for remembering these instructions and the sweet fellowship that we've just experienced. And so that is the function of a Vesper service. It is intended, I believe, to kind of settle and to quiet and prepare us for the evening and to for our refreshment of the night, so that on the morrow we can resume once more feasting and join one another. And so the Vesper service is intended to prepare our minds for the evening hours. I notice that there is a screen. I hope that you do not expect any video or audio program, because I really am a mentally defective technician. I have no skills as it relates to the computer or to any visual aids, and so I am devoid of that. Likewise, I am lacking in musical talent, and therefore cannot present to you any soloists or those who might be more qualified to give you the evening of music and enjoyment. But we trust that our little program tonight will be a source of helpfulness to you. Because we've tried to polarize it about an article in the reprints. An article written by a sister, Rebecca Fair Donny. She's a poetess, and under the caption of The Christian's Battle, and that's page 4580, she just has a dialogue in five stanzas, as it were, the dialogue between the old creature and the new creature, as it relates to various subjects that pertain to the Christian life: forgiveness, generosity, ingratitude, evil surmising, and judging. And all that I would like to do tonight is simply to bring to mind the machinations of the flesh, of the old creature, in its efforts to perpetuate itself and to subvert the will of God in our lives, and then the resolution that the new creature has made following the handling and the understanding of the problem. You know, as we have come to the Lord, we recognize that we have a new mind. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus. And so all of the impulses, desires, and needs, and survival of the fleshly mind have to be subordinated to the new. And as it were, the new creature is a interloper who enters the human life of the old man and then redirects it like a bridle upon the mouth of a horse, a wild Mustang, and then tames it and brings it into useful service for the Lord. So is our new creature overcoming and controlling and containing the impulses of the flesh. And the flesh, to ensure its survival, will strive to use every means and method in order to subvert that control. And so this poem, I think, is intended to create situations whereby the old man reacts, the resolution of the new creature. And so it'll be simply Brother David Yambor will be presenting the position of the flesh, the old creature. Sister Ruth Cunningham will be presenting the position of the new creature. But in between the two, we will try to mediate, as it were, the position of the new creature resolving the seeming problem. And then there'll be one or two readings thereafter, and we will move on from there. And so the first that Sister Noni addresses is this little dialogue between the old and new creatures around the area of forgiveness. Brother David will just present the old man's position.
Your brother has offended you. Must you forgiveness show when he has not forgiveness asked? I really do not know that you are called to go that far. He's very much to blame. Of course, I would not slander him, nor injure his good name. But then I think I'd show him too that he has quite offended you.
There is a real problem. The old man has been humiliated. The old man feels that there is a legitimate reason why a brother should be manifest as been proven wrong and letting him know that he has been an offender. And as in all matters, there is a little bit of truth, a half-truth, in what the flesh might be saying. Yes, there was an offense. But now the solution to that offense is what the new creature must now attempt to resolve. How does one handle one who has been insensitive to what deeds they have been doing? How should we ourselves react? And what should we do in order to help that brother? The new creature would certainly go to the scriptures. And there one would consider the prodigal son, for example. The prodigal son wanted his inheritance, and he decided to leave. And in his excesses, he squandered away his portion. But as he came unto himself and he resolved to return home, the beautiful thrust of that story is that the father was waiting, anxiously awaiting, hoping that someday he would return. And thus he did. You see, he had been forgiven even before he had asked for it. In his heart, the father knew that his son was worthy of love and could be reclaimed. And therefore, in full assurance, he awaited the time when he would come unto himself. If we forgive from the heart, we ourselves are clear. Even though the one who is offended is still in his guilt and still has to work out that problem himself, but we are there always in our hearts, knowing that we have no animosity, and that we are waiting for redemption, waiting for healing. And in that attitude, we are best able to support and to help and to affirm. Joseph, in his confrontation with his brethren, ends it by saying, "You meant it for ill, but God meant it for good." The mistreatment, the treachery of his brothers, he was able to overlook, knowing that there was a divine intent and purpose that was far more important than any personal affront or injury that he himself may have sustained. And in his heart, he was forgiving his brethren. They had to work out their misdeeds. And until they were showing the proper attitude of forgiveness, they were still guilty of that. But Joseph was ever ready to welcome them to that point of repentance with all his heart. And so, forgiveness. Forgiveness is in our heart, and no one can offend or hurt if we really have that quality of love, which Jesus inculcated when he said that if we do not forgive others, we cannot ask forgiveness from the Father. The new creature, in considering these alternatives, then responds to which Sister Ruth Cunningham will now give us.
How can I be a child of God and not forgiveness show? Why, he has covered all my sins, and I must surely grow in that sweet grace which from the heart forgives by word and deed. I would be like the blessed Lord, for in his word I read that he left all the joys of heaven to die that I might be forgiven.
And now we should like to have a little reading from the pen of that wise and faithful servant. Brother Tom Williams will do that for us.
Forgiveness. The disposition to forgive should be with us always and should be manifested by us at all times. Our loving generosity and kindness and desire to think no evil or as little as evil as possible should be manifest by all the words and acts of life. This is God-like. God had a kind, benevolent, generous sentiment toward us, even while we were yet sinners. Nor did he wait for the sinners to ask forgiveness, but promptly manifested his desire for harmony and his readiness to forgive. The whole gospel message is to this effect, quote, "Be reconciled to God," end quote. Our hearts should be so full of this disposition toward forgiveness that our faces would not have a hard look, nor our words of reproof a bitter sting. They should manifest the loving forgiveness that we should have in our hearts at all times. Forgiveness, quote, "in your hearts," end quote, is the condition which is always to obtain there. We should never harbor any other feeling than that of forgiveness and goodwill toward all. No matter how seriously they may have trespassed against us. And if this be the case, we will be longing and anxious to exercise forgiveness outwardly and to express it to the repentant ones. Hence, we will not seek to compel the most elaborate statement on the part of the penitent, but, like the father of the prodigal, to see the repentant one coming in an attitude of humility, will touch our hearts and prompt us to go out partway to meet him and to forgive him and to kiss him and to put on the robe of fullest fellowship and brotherhood. If ye forgive not men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you your trespasses. Matthew 6:15. Is that it?
We can now have a little hymn. And would you join in singing 354? Certainly most appropriate to this time of the day and into the spirit of the theme. 354. Is one of the choicest of Christian graces. Certainly is a very important part of that element of love. Without generosity, the human spirit would be famished and barren. And yet, the old man is of a selfish, egocentric nature and seeks its own. And that is always a problem in the new creature life. Now, the old preacher speaks to the problem of generosity.
Your brother has imposed on you, says, all that's thine is mine. It is not right. What shall you do? Where do you draw the line? Why should you share your earthly goods, which you by thrift acquired? That which you toil for is your own, and you are not required to give to everyone who comes to seek your help, your bread, your home.
A real problem for the flesh, isn't it? We acquire, we keep, we hoard unto ourselves. And now, requests are given which seem to be extreme, or almost to the degree of presumption. What should be our reaction and response? Well, again, the half-truths. And again, the subtle innuendos and a subtle means of caring for itself reveals in their reactions. It's not that everyone is asking. It's not that there isn't any need, but it's just a matter of imposition. And they have a little muchly imposed upon us. When Jesus, at the end of a busy day, healing throughout Judea, as the twilight descended, saw the crowd of 5,000, they had eagerly listened to his messages and they had eagerly sought his relief from their diseases and problems. The disciples said to him, just as we have heard, you ought to send them away. It's been a long day. We're tired. And besides, we have nothing more that we can give them. And the Master, of course, used that setting as one of the greatest of his miracles, the feeding of the 5,000. He didn't have to do it. He had done so much already. But he'd given and given and gave all that he could. And so, is there any limits to our giving? Of course there is. But oft times, the humanity of us draws those limits rather sharply and with restriction. It is true that we have to do good unto all men, especially unto the household of faith, and that we have to provide for our own. And he who does not is worse than the heathen has denied the faith. Therefore, we must be parsimonious. We must be diligent. We must be careful in how we dispense what we do have. But the Christian challenge is to how do we minimize our own needs? How do we lay on the altar of sacrifice our desires, our pleasures, our non-essentials, so that we might have more to offer to the Lord and to his cause and to his people? That is a test of true consecration and sacrifice. And oh, the flesh is going to claim its own and protest and seek in order to minimize your sacrifice for its own ends. And now, the new creature's reaction to this seeming problem.
I've often wished that I had lived when my Lord left his throne and trod this earth in human form, that I might then have shown my love to him in service sweet. But still the suffering Christ walks by my side, each day and now, neglected, poor, despised, still needing ministries of love. Now here's the chance my love to prove.
A poem entitled Giving, be read by Sister Lynn York.
Love withheld is lost at last, so may we learn someday. The only things we truly have are those we give away. And kindness that is never used but hid instead of shown will slowly disappear, you know, and change the heart to stone. The things we'd hoard for self we're apt to lose someday. The only things we really keep are those we give away.
Brethren, shall we unite in singing the spirit of the oneness of the body? Let us sing the first and last of hymn number 23, binding our hearts together in Christian love. And in that love, realizing we manifest it by our generosity of spirit, by our generosity of outpouring of the alabaster boxes of our hearts for one another, but also to realize, too, that that alabaster box may cost us something of the flesh, of the material, and so we are anxious, eager, willing to offer that to the glory of God and to the assistance of one another. First and last of hymn number 23. Other side of the coin. Generosity is our blessed privilege to offer. If the Lord has situated us whereby we can be liberal, how we ought to thank Him that we have more to put on that altar of sacrifice. But then, the other side, when there is not the kind of gratitude expressed, when there seems to be a insensitivity to the good that you are doing, when your efforts seem to be taken for granted, does that require our persistence in so doing? Are we to withhold? Should we not sacrifice? The sin of ingratitude. The old man would thus present the problem.
Your brother shows no gratitude for all your kindly deeds. He surely should express some thanks when you supply his needs. You've loaned, you've given, you've gone without, you've helped him all you could. I really think, in counting up, you've done more than you should. I'd call a halt till he has seen how kind you've always been.
Oh, how sometimes we all feel that way, haven't we? As though we've done what we could and we've gone beyond the measure. Somehow the results do not seem to be as much as we had hoped for. The reaction is not as spontaneous or as glowing or as demonstrative as we would like. Does not that almost bring you to mind of those who are around the masters, in which, as they were going into the temple, there was the Pharisee, there was the publican, there they were, and along comes a widow, putting in her little mite. Nobody paid attention to her. But when the banker, when the wealthy man produced his shekels and watched them or demonstrated a clinging into the box, how others looked and regarded them as holy people, sacrificing people, good people, righteous people, law-keeping people. And that little widow, just seemingly insignificantly, would just sulk away as though she had been insignificant. But the master observed this parade, and he said that she was more noble than all of them. She gave what she could. You see, those who were demonstrative, they received their reward. They got the praises of men. They, as the Pharisees and scribes, they were seated in the first chief seats. They were looked upon as the holy men and representatives of the Mosaic tradition. They were the leaders and chiefs of Israel. But we see that the widow, without any thought of return, just loving of God and His arrangements, gave all that she could. And the Master demonstrated this principle, didn't he? This principle of non-gratitude. But it didn't deter him from giving and doing good. Remember, there were 10 lepers. All of them had that horrible, incurable disease. All of them were social outcasts. All of them were human wrecks. All of them were physical disabled, deteriorating into a state of helplessness and hopelessness. And there these outcasts, 10 of them, were all healed. Oh, how they rejoiced and how they were beyond description in their renewal of life, as it were. And then the Master, in accordance with his awareness that he was to work within that system, he had not yet rejected that system, iniquity had not yet come to the full. It did at the end of his 3.5 years. When he said, "Behold, your house is left desolate unto you." But until that time, he gave every possible opportunity, every lesson, so that he might possibly help to reform. But he knew that that was not within the Lord's province. But yet, he recognized that arrangement of the law while he was still under it. And so he told them, "Show yourselves to the priest. Go through this ritual of purification, so then you might be accepted back into the congregation of Israel as a full-fledged human being once more." Because these lepers were treated so unclean that they were ostracized from society. But then when they had gone to the priests, when they had rejoicingly shown their cure, only one returned. Only one out of 10. And the Master asks, "Where are the other 9? But that did not deter the Master from his work of witnessing, declaring the miracles which would herald his being the Messiah. No, that did not deter him whatever. Ingratitude was inborn in the human depraved heart. But he did what he could. Just as that widow with her little mite. And so let us do good. Let us continue, not being discouraged, deterred, not being detoured from our work of laying it all on the altar of sacrifice. The new creature comes to that conclusion, and in this poetic way, Sister Doni expresses it.
"What? Work for thanks? Then I should lose a future rich reward. All service to my brother now is done for my dear Lord. Each little sacrifice I make is precious in His sight. To see my love and zeal abound, I know is His delight. For all the wealth beneath the sun, I would not miss His sweet well done."
Sister Bessie Kasiak will tell us a little bit more about that, and Brother Russell's reaction to that.
"Gratitude. Gratitude is therefore a keeping power in our hearts. There is to repel the suggestion of the evil one, and to stop our imperfect fleshly mind if it attempts to assert itself. Gratitude is closely akin to love, and where they dwell together in the heart, there is little room for the adversary to get in his work. On the contrary, ingratitude signifies a blindness of the mind in respect to justice. It speaks a low standard of character in which the fruits of the Spirit of the Lord have not been well developed. Surely in any heart in which the love of God has been shed abroad, ingratitude to him or anybody would be an impossibility. But where ingratitude gains a foothold, it admits its relatives, selfishness, pride, anger, malice, hatred, strife, evil surmisings, slander, backbitings, and other qualities which the apostle enumerates as works of the flesh and the devil. The Lord's consecrated people should daily search their hearts for any manifestations of selfishness or ingratitude, and should look well to the growing development therein of love and thankfulness and appreciation toward the giver of all good, toward the brethren of the household of faith, yea, toward all with whom we have to do. The poem, Thanksgiving. Now Jesus once led 10 lepers healed, but only one returned, and offered thanks and praised and kneeled, and his gratitude he learned. We too were lepers touched by sin, but he had justified and cleansed us from what we have been and hath us sanctified. May we his praises ever tell, to all his plan make known, for gratitude does imply our debts to him to own.
Thank you. As given in the quote from the pastor, gratitude, ingratitude, is closely allied to the evils of slander and evil speaking. Again, how prevalent that is in the reactions of the humanity and of the flesh.
Your brother slandered you, I hear, and tried on you to throw suspicious base to injure you, told things that were not so, surmised that you had evil done, tells others of his fears, with coolness meets your looks of love, and cost you many tears. You do not owe him in return a love which he will only spurn.
Again, how the suspicion, how the guardedness rears its ugly head. Your brother slandered you, I hear, and tried on you to throw suspicious base to injure you. Oh, immediately that should send up a red flare, a warning signal. Your brother slandered you, I hear. Oh, how that word G-O-S-S-I-P rears its ugly head. Your brother slandered you. Oh, I got it second-handed, third-handed. And so, you don't know what he's saying behind your back. Oh, how that suspicion, oh, how that evil speaking would divide and would instill bitterness in one's heart if one would allow it to fester. When one hears anything about another and hears it second, third, or whatever hand it may be, how we need, if the new creature life and if the principles of righteousness were instilled in our hearts, how we need to quench that conflagration by coming to its source and rejecting hearsay and rejecting gossip about another and confronting the gossiper with the dangers in which they might be in if they persist in talking about others. How so much of this would be quenched, and how we would prevent so many ill feelings and misunderstanding amongst our fellowship. If only we could recognize, if only we could identify those seemingly idle words that's just gush forth from us, that leave behind impressions, or that give the sense that there is something wrong and of suspicion. Oh, brethren, as the Apostle James spends 2 or 3 chapters talking about the dangers and the powerful trouble that the tongue can express and the beautiful helpfulness and blessing it can give, but it must be controlled properly. It must be based on principles of love and soundness and of justice. Is it true? And then we can ask the other questions to pass those three gates of gold. If it is true, then you entertain it, and then you can rejoice in it. Then you can treat it. But if it's not, if it's merely innuendo, then you just dismiss it. Oh, how our fellowship would be enriched if we could only even more be on guard against such dangers. And no more does the adversary find wedges between the brethren than by these careless words or by the sometimes unintended slurs that just seems to come forth from our idle speaking tongue. And so, dear friends, let us root out from our hearts any bitterness or any sense of injustice as we relate one to the other.
"'Tis not my brother you hold up, 'tis not his faults you show. It is my brother's enemy, like you, a deadly foe. My brother does not do the things that you lay at his door. 'Tis his old creature that one day shall trouble him no more. The new creature is my kin. The new creation does no sin."
The essence of those remarks are also contained in the manner of February the 13th. And Brother Norman Sandler will read that for us.
The manner for February 13th, taken from 1 Corinthians 13:5, reads, "Love thinketh no evil. Whoever neglects the Lord's commandments along this line of evil surmising weaves himself a web of his own ensnarement, however circumspectly he may walk, as respects other matters. For a heart impregnated with doubt and suspicion towards his fellow creatures is more than half prepared to doubt God. The spirit of sourness and bitterness is at war with the spirit of the Lord, the spirit of love. Either the one or the other will conquer. The wrong spirit must be gotten rid of, or it will defile the new creature and make him a castaway. On the contrary, if the new nature conquer as an overcomer, it will be along the line, if evil surmisings are overcome, half the battle against present difficulties and besetments is won. In the poem, "Only a Little Thing," it was only a tiny seed, carelessly brushed aside, but it grew in time to a noxious weed and spread its poison wide. It was only a little leak, so small you might hardly see, but the rising waters found the break and wrecked the great levee. It was only a single spark dropped by a passing train, but the dead leaves caught and swift and dark was its work on wood and plain. It was only a thoughtless word, scarce meant to be unkind, but it pierced as a dart to the heart that heard and left its sting behind. It may seem a trifle at most, the thing that we do or say, and yet it may be that at fearful cost we may wish it undone someday."
The importance of little things, how they can cause the greater catastrophes of life. Yes, if we allow the little seeds, the little sparks, the little germs to grow and to fester and to glow, how they will erupt in the great conflagration or the cancer of sin. Let us sing hymn number 143A as one of the antidotes to these little foxes that would spoil the grapes, the little faults, the little casual secret sins, perhaps, that if we are not on guard against, will undermine our walk. More holiness give me. Source of spiritual conflict is the matter of judging how we make the wrong judgments and how judging one another can be such a serious offense and a great blow to our spiritual reality. The old creature would pose the problem of a brother who just doesn't appreciate us.
Your brother claims he walks in love. Then why is he so mean? In many people of the world, there's more goodness seen than he shows in his daily life. You know you're vexed with him. He has such ugly little ways and such besetting sins. He sorely lacks in Christian grace. Now how can he win the race?
You know, again, there is a kind of half-truth in what the flesh is saying. He said, why, there are so many people of the world where there's more goodness seen than he shows in his daily life. And I'm sure that's true. Because God has not called the wise and the great and the noble and the good of this world, but he has called the little ignoble ones. He called the sinners and publicans to repentance. And so if we are comparing ourselves with the natural, yes, indeed, it is true that we pale by comparison. But you know, the Lord determines who is to be our spiritual neighbors. We have no control over our relatives, so they happen to be on the scene when we arrive. But the Lord, He puts together the fellowship of brethren. He assembles you in the little ecclesia that you meet, and I in mine, for the very purpose of putting us together for mutual helpfulness, for mutual testings, for mutual encouragement. So little wonder that there is abrasiveness. Little wonder that we do experience irritation at times. Oh, there is so much more of glorious and oneness and sweet fellowship in the Lord and in the Spirit, and how we just exult at conventions like this and in our home ecclesias as we work together for a common cause of Christ. But there are times when the irritations of the flesh seem to flare, and we wonder, how could the Lord be dealing with such? At those moments, we must be especially on guard, because humanity will use that as pretenses to draw a wedge between brethren. Oh, and if there's any impulse towards bitterness in our heart, or any pride, ostentation, or demanding, how quickly it can have its inroads, and how we can have a barrier created against one another. You know, the world has a word for it. When it comes to finding fault with others and judging them, the psychologist tells us that that could be a symptom of what they call projection. That you see in others the some faults that which are within yourself. Some of the secret faults that you have, you project on others, and you suspect that they are the same way. The miser is very jealous about his hoard, for fear of someone wanting to take them from him. The proud man sees others as being proud, and therefore they, in defense, can justify their pride. You see, if we find ourselves chronically making judgments and tending towards criticism or trying to find fault, perhaps it is a sign that the Lord is giving us that we need to look within and see whether or not we are guilty of these defects and project them onto others as almost the way of justifying ourselves for reacting the way we do. Oh, the prophet said that the human heart is desperately wicked beyond all things. And oh, how it makes these mental tricks if, again, the new creature is not on guard. And so, it was Eli who saw Hannah. There she was at the steps of the temple. And as she seemed to be in a state of extreme anxiety, he wanted to usher her away. Oh, she had no place in the holy temple. Insensitive to the fact that here she was praying with the earnestness of her spirit, pouring out her heart to the Lord to give an heir, to give a child to whom she might render to the Lord in devoted service because she loved Jehovah so much. And how he misconstrued entirely her motives. He judged improperly. So let us not try to judge others' motives. Yes, we can judge their fruits. We're to be aware of them. But we are to see the potential within them and not give up. We are to see that they are endeavoring to fight against the same difficulties. Perhaps they have their blind spots, just like we do too. but just to abandon them or to react in rejection. Ah, dear friends, that is the judgment that the Lord condemns. Let us not judge before the times. And so, the new creature.
The way is getting narrower, more steep and rough it grows, and fewer they who walk therein. Lord, I would be of those who walk on to the very end, through good report or ill. My chief desire, to know and do thy blessed holy will. Complete in me thy work of grace, that I may see thee face to face.
And now, concluding this theme of judging, Brother McAllister will read us a quote and a brief poem.
The pastor writes on judgment, "It is not the imperfect actions of the mortal body that will determine anything, but the heart intentions and endeavors of the new creature. The body must be kept under and brought into subjection, as the Apostle Paul tells us. It is the new creature that will live or die, so far as the church is concerned, under the judgment of the divine law, the divine lawgiver." In harmony with the thought of our text, the Apostle Paul declares that neither the world nor brethren were capable of judging him, that only the Lord, who can read the heart and know all the conditions, testings, and weaknesses to be striven against, can properly judge. He even declares, "Yea, I judge not mine own self," 1 Corinthians 4:3. We should neither condemn others who claim to be walking conscientiously as children of the Lord, nor condemn ourselves if we know we are truly striving to thus walk. We should simply press along day by day, doing the best we can by the Lord's assisting grace to cultivate the fruits of the Holy Spirit and serve our Master, leaving all the results with him. In a poem, "If we only understood, could we draw aside the curtains that surround each other's lives, see the naked heart and spirit, know what spur the action gives, often we would find it better, purer than we judge the world, than we judge we would. We would love each other better if we only understood. Could we judge all deeds by motives, see the good and bad within? Often we would love the sinner, all the while we loathe the sin. Could we know the powers working to overthrow integrity? We would judge each other's errors with more patient charity. If we knew the cares and trials, knew the efforts all in vain and the bitter disappointments, understood the loss and gain, would the grim external roughness seem, I wonder, just the same? Would we help where now we hinder? Would we pity where we blame? Oh, we judge each other harshly, knowing not life's hidden force, knowing not the fount of action is less turbid at its source. Seeing not amid the evil all the golden grains of good, oh, we'd love each other better if we only understood."
A Vesper service, the afterglow of the day. If we can dwell with the thoughts that we've learned, the talks that we've heard, and the hearts that we have opened as we discussed amongst ourselves. And truly, this will have been a day of blessing. As you go.